Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Emerson Green. So we left off last time talking about the failure of analysis and hinting that our underlying view of concepts might be to blame. This next part is a little difficult because it requires a certain amount of accumulated experience to really land. By that I mean you need to have seen others try and fail to define seemingly simple terms. A famous example is game. It is surprisingly hard to define a word like that, considering we use it all the time, and so must know what it means on some level. If you've never seen proposed definitions of game get shot down with counterexamples over and over again, you might not believe me and think it's really easy to define game. This is why Humer doesn't cover his view of concepts until showing us the failure of analysis with respect to knowledge. Philosophers in the 20th century tried very hard to analyze that particular term, and yet there are good counterexamples to every proposed analysis. The reason I wanted to cover this topic is exactly because I was already familiar with the difficulty of conceptual analysis, with providing a set of conditions that correctly classifies things in all possible circumstances. I already knew that it seemed impossible with philosophically interesting terms, so the section of Humer's book examining more fundamental assumptions that led to the problem jumped out at me. But if you don't occupy a position like that on the epistemic landscape, one where you can see the extreme difficulty of analysis, then this part isn't quite as groundbreaking. But I'm not going to spend a chunk of time going through a Socratic dialogue, trying and failing to analyze terms like game, cause, time, justice, and so on just to prove the point. I'll just link some resources that go through that process and take it as an assumption going forward that correctly classifying things in all possible circumstances, providing a set of necessary and sufficient conditions free from all counterexamples, is damn near impossible with philosophically interesting terms.
Well, I think philosophy got off on the wrong foot several thousand years ago when Socrates and Plato convinced people that they should look for essential properties and try to, Euclidify philosophy. Geometry was the obvious candidate for the most wonderful and perfect science there was, and the idea was to make philosophy as much like geometry as possible. And that just turns out to be a big mistake. In the real world, outside of the world of mathematics, there just aren't very many bright lines, clear edges, definitions that will stand the test of counterexamples. And philosophers for several thousand years have spent way too much time fighting over definitions and being counterexample mongers when they should take a deep breath, adopt population thinking as derived from Darwin, and recognize that this process of strict definition and proof, which is, for many philosophers, it's just what philosophy is in almost every area doomed. And they should just recognize that and revise their practice.
The actual shape of our concepts, so to speak, is fuzzy and complex, not neat and sharp and precise. Indefinability is a consequence of those fuzzy borders. The secret is that indefinability is not a problem, or more provocatively, it doesn't matter that we can't successfully define the words we use. Think about the gradual evolution of language and about how we acquired language. Did you just sit down and study a dictionary? No, you heard others using language and you mimicked their usage. You figured out what words meant by noticing how others used them. Which came first, language or dictionaries? We were acquiring and using language long, long before we tried to systematically define every word we use. And how did we generate those dictionaries in the first place? We basically just consulted linguistic intuition, testing it against specific cases, which basically means imagining using it in different contexts and just seeing if it sounds right or not. Of course, it's entirely natural to think that you can only use a concept once you already know what it means, and knowing what it means requires being able to give a good definition of it. There's a view of concepts implicit in this way of approaching the issue, which Hume calls the Lockean view of concepts after John Locke. Quote, 1. Concepts are introspectively observable mental items. 2. Most concepts are constructed out of other concepts. 3. Introspection is reasonably reliable. 4. Therefore, for most concepts, we should be able to see how the concept is constructed from other concepts. End quote. This way of approaching concepts doesn't always fail. If you think about a relatively simple geometrical concept, like a triangle, we can see that triangle is composed of other concepts. 3, straight line, closed. If you understand the concept triangle, then you can introspect and see that it involves these other concepts. In other words, the concept is constructed out of other concepts. So when it comes to philosophically interesting concepts like justice, knowledge, causation, time, and so on, we should be able to go about it in the same way, right? Well, this is what philosophers have been trying and failing to do. With the exception of some simple concepts, mathematical concepts, and technical definitions where we just stipulate what it means, analysis has not yet yielded a perfect definition of pretty much anything. In fact, if some future philosopher does correctly analyze knowledge, the definition would be so convoluted that it wouldn't be helpful to anyone who didn't already understand the word. If someone wanted to understand the term, telling them the correct definition would probably confuse them more than just giving examples of how to use it. That would be the better path to understanding. Quote, there are three things wrong with the Lockean view. First, understanding a word, except in rare cases, is not a matter of knowing a definition. Understanding a word is a matter of having the appropriate dispositions to use that word, being disposed to apply the word to the things that it applies to, and not apply it to the things it doesn't apply to. Accordingly, the way we learn words is hardly ever by being given a verbal description of the word's meaning. We learn almost all of our words by observing others using the words in context. We then attempt to imitate others' usage, to apply the word in circumstances that seem to us similar to those in which we have previously observed others using the word. Each time we hear the word used, that slightly influences our dispositions. You understand a given word to the extent that you can successfully imitate the accepted usage. End quote. Hume goes on to argue that concepts are generally not constructed out of other simple concepts, like in the case of triangle, and that concepts are not always introspectively observable. Understanding a word is a matter of having the appropriate dispositions to use the word. Concepts are dispositional mental states. Our main access to a concept comes, quote, not through directly reflecting on the concept, but through activating the dispositions that constitute our understanding. End quote. We can do this in real life or just in our imaginations. We imagine a situation and are inclined to use certain words and not others. This not only tracks with how we actually learned language to begin with, but also with the common method of checking definitions by consulting our linguistic intuitions. Quote, if the way we applied concepts were by applying a pre-given definition, then this methodology would be backwards. We would reject intuitions that conflict with our pre-given definitions, rather than the other way around. End quote. We don't just keep insisting that knowledge is justified true belief after we've been given counterexamples. We say, yeah, it actually seems like that person didn't have knowledge in that Gettier case. We don't say, well, actually, they did have knowledge because it satisfied our pre-given definition. This use-based way of understanding the meaning of terms is of course going to be fuzzier and more complex than a rigidly defined, geometrically precise method. Usage is messy. So there will pretty much always be edge cases, things that don't seem to quite fit on either side of a sharp line. On this view of concepts, that's to be expected. A perfectly good concept will, nonetheless, admit of borderline cases. It's not some kind of big point against the concept, or your understanding of it, just because there are a couple edge cases. The radical-sounding conclusion of all this is that understanding is constituted by knowing how to use a word, and not by being able to provide a perfect definition. You can understand a concept without being able to provide a set of conditions that correctly classifies things in all circumstances. It's misguided, and kind of pointless to get hung up on this activity of endless conceptual analysis. As Dennett said earlier, for a lot of philosophers, that just is philosophy, and it's a total dead end. Quote, indefinability of words is perfectly normal and does not pose a problem, since understanding is not constituted by knowledge of definitions. The best way to convey a word's meaning is through examples. End quote. This brings us to a particular passage I came across in Randall Rouser's book, The Doubter's Creed, How to Be a Christian When You Don't Believe It's True. I interviewed Rouser about the main subject of the book, if you're interested. In attempting to define naturalism, Rouser explains the method of ostensive definition by negation. Quote, if one gives an ostensive definition of something, one defines that thing indirectly by pointing to examples that satisfy the definition. For example, you could define ball by providing a formal definition like, a ball is a spherical object. Though American football fans might disagree, but you could also define ball indirectly by pointing to things that satisfy the definition. A basketball, a bowling ball, a ball bearing, and so on. Second, the idea of defining something by negation involves defining it indirectly by saying what it is not. For example, you might begin to define courage by saying it isn't cowardice, it isn't weakness, and it isn't laziness. End quote. Rouser brings this up in the context of defining naturalism, which often involves ostensive definition by negation. Naturalists often describe their view by giving examples of supernatural, religious, or things otherwise deemed spooky that they don't believe in. Giving examples, including negative examples, is a good way to convey a term's meaning. Showing how the word is used, activating the dispositions that constitute understanding, is more important than being able to give a dictionary-worthy definition. That is, if understanding is the aim. This isn't just the case with naturalism. It's true for most, if not all, philosophically interesting concepts. Understanding a concept is not a matter of knowing a definition. The Wittgensteinian view of concepts explains how it's possible that everyone knows how to competently use terms, even though it's so hard to successfully analyze them. I can't provide a perfect conceptual analysis of knowledge, and yet I have no issue using the term. In fact, I feel fine rejecting proposed analyses of knowledge. I reject the justified true belief analysis, since it seems wrong to say that I have knowledge of the time when I'm looking at a broken clock. Not only can I competently use terms that I can't analyze, I can reject proposed analyses as insufficient. That's because I know what the term means despite the fact that I can't define it. You can actually make a name for yourself just through proving the point that it is hard, if not impossible, to give a perfect definition of a philosophically interesting term. If you just pop out of the bushes and demand to know the necessary and sufficient conditions free from all counterexamples of any word, you will stump a lot of people. Especially if you already know those people have edge cases at the forefront of their minds. One note on edge cases. While it's true that there will always be borderline cases, that shouldn't be abused. That fact doesn't give us free rein to define anything terribly since, hey, there will always be counterexamples and edge cases. Taxonomies are more or less useful depending on how comfortably things fit into the categories within the taxonomy. There shouldn't be mostly borderline cases. They should be few and far between. A perfectly good concept will still have some edge cases, but you don't want mostly counterexamples in edge cases. So with that, thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.